glasses. You should know that before you speak.
And if you object strongly, then I won't record. So everybody has to kind of be in agreement when we do this, because it does go up on FUB. And sometimes people do get a bit uncomfortable about it, but after a while, you get used to being recorded. I was recorded for years. You know, I was a bit unsettled by it to begin with, but I find out nobody actually trawls through it and says, "What? You said that?" Anyway, that was when I was at the university, and sometimes I'd be critical of people in power, you know, but they never seemed to bother, let's put it that way. So we've got a couple of new people today. So last week we did a brief introduction of who we are, why we're here. Oh yes, you can come and sit by me. So we've got three new people today, and you're all sitting together for some. So I'm just saying just a brief introduction from each of you, just so that we're kind of up to speed. The sort of thing I'm looking for is who you are, where you came from, why you're here. It doesn't have to be a huge thing, but
yeah.
Yes.
Right, I'm Anthony Evans, from Marine Surgery. I'm a software engineer. I've been here for 4 years. The reason why I came here was I read an introduction to philosophy a few years ago, and I was really into it. But I couldn't really take it further without discussing it with someone else. So I thought it might be. I saw this, and I thought this would be quite good, because I think it's one thing to read ideas, but it's another one to discuss them. And so that's what I'm doing.
Great. So. lovely and succinct. And John, I know John because I do, yes.
John knows my story. We knew each other very when we were very young. I recently returned from about 15 years in India, where I was studying and working in an archive situation at a museum in India with the photography section. And I came along because John and I discussed this class many times, and
I'd just be interested to see what it was. Having
done a lot of meditation and maybe practical philosophy.
Yes.
Margarita. I'm Margarita. I'm from Greece. I've done a bit of philosophy in the past. When I was at school, I did a bit of Plato and Aristotle, but I remember being very confused when I was doing that. But I guess I'm just interested in philosophy in general, and that's why I'm here.
Yes. Good. And Michael, are you Greek as well?
You're
Greek.
Yeah.
No, I'm just checking.
Yeah.
Don't want to admit to.
We came
yes. Yeah. No, the thing is, we do use Greek terms here, and I've no idea how to pronounce them. So, I don't mind being helped.
Words in Greek.
Yes.
I was just
well, I still think there's going to be some late arrivals. It's all right. Can you sit around here just so we're in a circle?
Okay.
Yeah, guys. Because I don't want a double circle, you know. So. We'll start adding people as we go. So, getting to the class, the reading this week, there's a sort of a way that I go about doing philosophy, which is I just sort of throw you in. I mean, there's a few people who've done this class before, not this class, but have done phenomenology before, so it's not quite as much a throwing in. But if you haven't done phenomenology before, then I'm just throwing you at Husserl. You know Matt, who runs the whole show here, the philosophy show. He always says to me, you can't do that, John. You can't just give them Husserl and expect people to understand what he's talking about, because he's kind of talking to already assumed his audience has a certain background in philosophy. But I've got a kind of a thing here where I don't think many people on earth understand Husserl. So professional philosophers included. So it's not as if I can give you a book by someone else to explain to you what Husserl has to say. I think everybody has to kind of come at it by themselves and work your way towards him by degrees. And partly this class is a way of doing that. So I'm sort of expecting you, your first time through Husserl, to maybe at a certain point. Do you know the feeling when you're reading something and you've lost it somewhere and it just becomes a bunch of words? Yes? But quite often you might start well, but there'll be a certain point and you're still reading, but nothing's really happening anymore. Do you know that feeling? Now, and I hate to say this, but I think a lot of people go through their entire degree and the material they're reading in their degree, they feel like that about all of it, but still manage to write an essay on it. But you see, the idea here, I guess if this course succeeds, is at the end of it, you might go back and read Husserl with some understanding. So I don't want you to be discouraged. The fact that you got even a certain way into what he was saying is a good thing. And the fact you couldn't understand what he was saying and it was all just words, something happens in that, but at least you remember some of the words and some of the phrases that you weren't understanding, so that when I start to go into it in class, there's something in you that I can reach rather than you knowing nothing. So there's a kind of a back and forth with Husserl where I think when you get to the heart of what he's talking about, then everything he says will have some sort of meaning to you. But to start with, it may well be that nothing he says has any meaning. And I'm always amazed as I come back to him over the years that I understand him better every time. And this is and a really good philosophy is like this. It's like you almost you circling around a piece of work, and each time you come back, suddenly you say, "Oh, there's more." You know, there's something deeper. There's a deeper. I understand now what he's saying. In a weird way, even though you thought, I mean, someone like me, I do. I think last year, I understood him. Yeah, but this year I see again. Oh no, there's another layer there. So I think a number of you will probably be on the right, on the outer layer, and it would the idea of this course is to get you into, you know, through layer one almost. But the other thing about this course and studying philosophy at all is the kind of abysmal state of our general education. Which isn't anyone's fault, you know, it's a historical thing. But we don't really have any historical context by which we understand our own culture anymore. At least that's my observation. Our whole education sort of lacks giving us the background where you could start to understand that broader understanding of the Greeks and where our civilization came from. How it differed from medieval civilization, you know, who the major philosophers are and what they said, all of this in some sort of ideal world in my own mind, you would all have learned that in school. I mean, what was school for? What was it for?
Free childcare.
Well, to teach you to read and write. I mean, basically, I think that's all that most people get out of it, doesn't it? You probably could have learned to read and write without bothering to go. I mean, no. I mean, you get socialised, don't you? You learn in the playground, hopefully, how to get by with other people. But beyond that, you see that.
You don't even learn to read.
Yes, well, let's not start being rude about. I think it's about education, but in a way, doing a course like this is also we have to try and kind of fill in this background sense of our whole culture. That's my introductory spiel today, because I'm about to get stuck on the very, you know what I do, I cut little pieces out, for those of you who weren't here last time. I cut little pieces out of the reading, but I don't let you know what they are, because I'm hoping you do the whole reading and kind of suffer your way through it rather than just read my excerpts. But I try and pick the key, you know, a few key pieces. But this week, unfortunately, the few key pieces are, you know, probably about 30% of the reading anyway. You know, because there's a lot of detail here. Now, the funny thing is that I've pretty much forgotten what I said last week. But we did cover, you know, what Husserl's saying in the first five sections here. He already said in the introduction, he's just saying it in more detail. So we'll be recovering some ground, but I don't think that that will hurt. But this week, as you can see, we've got pictures as well. And here's Galileo. So I'm mixing, I'm going into multimedia here, not just words. And I try to get some key quotes from these figures to really sum up, you know, some core of what they might be saying. Measure what is measurable and make measurable what is not so. There's a good, marvellous essence of Galileo. Now, the importance of Galileo to Husserl's thinking and to the whole of phenomenology is in the previous sections of the book that I left out. You know, there's a big wodge, we jumped from the introduction right up to section 10. The entire bit in the middle is all about Galileo and what he calls Galilean science. And as I mentioned, I think, I cover that in another course on science. But at the same time, I feel I need to give you some kind of picture of this extraordinary event in human history that is modern science. And I pause at the immensity of trying to tell you this in 10 or 15 minutes because it's so significant, not as a piece of information to be filed away in your memory, but as a kind of an understanding of the very mindset of our entire culture. Our entire culture, you know, when we're talking about science and reason, as if they're sort of ideas that Husserl's talking about, that don't, I mean, initially they will, I think, appear as something that don't, that aren't immediately relevant to you. And that's what I want to kind of get across, is that the scientific revolution and what it represented are at the kind of... Michael, by the way, I feel I'm back at university, but I need everyone's attention and not on a screen.
Just taking notes.
Yes, I know, taking notes, but there's something about it. I feel like I need your full attention, and it's all on recorded anyway, because in some way we're understanding what science and reason are about is almost like a matter of looking within at how it operates in us. So I want to give you a quick synopsis of the 10 sections that we missed out about what Husserl is trying to explain about science and what an extraordinary thing it is, and throw in a bit of Jung as well. Because Jung regarded the advent of science as a change in the human psyche. I'm kind of shocked when we go in history programs on the television and you go back to medieval times or to ancient Greece or to Egypt, and there's a kind of an assumption in there that they were like us. That they saw the world like we do. There's a kind of a whole missing sense of the world was seen differently before science came on the scene. And that's what I mean by saying that if I was to tell you, if you ask you about the scientific revolution, you may be able to tell me very little about it. And if I was to ask you to define what science is, you might start going, not sure, as if it was something separate from you. But what I would, the sense of what science is that it is infected is a bad word, formed our entire, shaped our entire understanding of being, of what being is here, what it means for something to be. I was mentioning Jung because his understanding, if you like, of what science did to the human psyche, it objectified the world for us. So, beforehand, you could say that there's a lot of psychic material in us that we encounter, say, when we dream, or if you have a vision or an extraordinary experience of some sort. Because the psyche is operating in us anyway, but it doesn't manifest as actual things around us very often anymore. And if it does, then people tend to keep it quiet. Do you know, if you actually do have a vision or you see something or something, an apparition, there's something that doesn't fit in with what we call the objective world, then it's sidelined for us. Whereas, it's certainly in medieval times, there was a free-flowingness between, if you like, the psyche and the dream world and the image world, that the church, you know, the Christian church, in a sense, was an expression of this. It was an expression of a symbolic inner world that was projected out onto Jesus and the saints, and the idea of the saints and the miracles. That there was a different sense of what is possible and what is real. For a long time, you could say that the psyche and the objective world, what we have come to call the psyche and the objective world, were interleaved, and there was no clear distinction between them. We lived, in effect, in this reality that we're sitting in now, but this was permeable by other things. There are other entities. The idea that there was God and the devil, this wasn't just an idea in your imagination or something that you believed. You know, there was a sense of a reality to things in the psyche that were operating here in the world. So I'm trying to give you a sense what science did, what European Western civilization, what it has done, if you like, is it has split those worlds, and now we've got a very definite and clear idea of what the objective world is, because a lot of this reading was about objectivism, yeah, as if it was a scientific position that a few philosophers might understand. But objectivism is something that permeates us through and through, whether we know it or not. And it comes out of a certain approach to understanding reality that you could say originated in the past, but it came to its kind of full clarity with the scientific revolution. And Galileo was the first person to, if you like, explicitly realize it and write it down and say, this is how we should do science. And this is where it becomes, you know, I have got a board. And, he explicitly, because the thing about a world that's permeated by the psyche is that it's not fixed. And there's no one version of it. And science became interested in there being one absolute version of reality that we could all agree on. That became the key to there being anything like an ability for a whole community of people across the earth, which is what we have now, being able to work on something and for it to progress without everybody just falling apart and saying, no, it's not like that. I see it like this. If you think about every other sphere of human life, that's how it is. People don't ever really progress in any way over decades or hundreds of years, because they all fall apart and say, well, no, it's not like that. I'm Islamic, I'm Christian. Or in the philosopher's world, I'm an idealist, I'm a materialist. Everybody when it comes to trying to understand the entire reality, it starts to fall into differences and disagreements, which mean that many of these fields, you just the entire time spent is spent engaged in argumentation. Think of politics. Do you know, if you don't have a fixed agreement on how things stand that everybody accepts, then you can't make systematic progress. And Galileo and Western Europe, as a civilization, recognised that there is... Yes, do come in.
I'm so sorry, we need to get...
Yeah, sure. And I've left the key in there, it's all open.
Thank
you. Yeah. Yes. We've got a second course this week. Are you okay in the other room?
Yes.
Yeah. So where was I? Yeah, this is the trouble with the stream of John's thought, you know, if it's stopped.
But you can't bring something forward unless it's sort of unified in
yes.
the system.
Yes, yes, yes. So Galileo recognised, I think for the first time clearly, that it's already in us, right? We already have a certain level of agreement about this being a book. You know, before science comes along, we say it's a book, and we don't argue about it because I can hand it to you, you can take it from me, and there's an objectification of the book in language. Right, we were taught as children what the word book means, and a whole lot of other stuff is already present to us in this way where we don't actually argue about the fact that there's a book on the table. The philosophers will argue about whether there's a material universe or whether it's all in the mind. You know, you can start to argue about what is the book really? But we don't actually argue about whether there's a book on the table or not, unless we're taking a lot of psychedelic. We can start worrying about whether we're hallucinating or not, but in general we don't do that. So there's a sort of a starting place where we do agree about the things around us, but ultimately we would start to disagree because we have no ground of agreement on something like the question of, well, what exactly is the quality that you're experiencing when you look at that cover? You call it purple, right? But what's purple? Would you call it purple, by the way? Yeah, we've got a word, purple, and we would agree that it's purple.
But then I guess a colorblind person would experience that differently.
Yes, but even what we're coming down to is, but. And we're almost getting to Descartes, but Galileo was thinking about this. But I don't know what you're seeing, whether you're colourblind or not. The actual quality of the colour that you're seeing, you may be seeing, if it were possible for me to transpose myself into your experience and still be in my experience, which it isn't, I might say, oh my God, you see it like that. Do you know if you could suddenly have two visual experiences, the one you're having and the one I'm having, you compare them? I mean, I think if you could do that, we would. My guess is we probably would agree on the colour. It would be an extraordinary universe if we didn't. But the way your eyes are and the way you may be starting to get cataracts, maybe I am. I compared my eyesight to someone much younger. I'd go, oh my God, it's so clear. You know, it would be like two different photographs in a way. But you can go right down to the level. There's no, we can reach no agreement about what it's actually like to see that colour. And Galileo set about saying, well, we've got to get rid of anything like that. Any doubt or uncertainty like that has to be removed. So, in a certain way, your colour experience is absolutely personal to you. And there's no way that we can reach any kind of agreement about anything like that that's going on in your personal sphere of consciousness. What, the only place we can reach agreement on is how things are out here. And even how things are out here, we can't reach a fundamental agreement about, even about the quality of colour. What we can reach agreement about, you know, and here he is what we can measure.
H2O is what the scientists agree, but it's water. Water, the feeling of water when you drink water, when you swim in water is...
Well,
it's
no,
not H2O.
When we get to H2O, we get to something later. This is later science, because you can't show me H2O, can you? Because at the moment, science starts on this ground of there's a book here, and everyone says, yeah, there's a book here. But if I show you a glass of water and I say that's H2O, well, you can't see that, can you? And even if you were to get an electron microscope and start to try and delve into trying to see the atoms, you're not seeing the atoms. You're seeing an image that is developed out of the bouncing of the electrons off something. You can't ever see atoms. When you get into science, you see, I don't want to jump into science as we have it now, because science as we have it now says, well, you can't ever see anything, really. I mean, all you're seeing is photonic energy, and even then, you're not seeing that. You're seeing what's going on in your brain as a result of that photonic energy hitting your retina. But that's, science hasn't got there yet, right? Back with Galileo, we're just starting on the path that's going to lead to that. Because at that moment, he recognized stuff like hot and cold. When something is hot now, we understand it, if we touch it, as the vibration of molecules, the kinetic energy of molecules vibrating. But Galileo didn't know that. But the reason that we came to see it that way is almost because we started out in a certain direction, looking towards something. What Galileo did is not was much more simple than that. He recognised that the only thing that we can agree on is what we can measure, and suddenly the whole rich experience of this world that we're in now becomes totally narrowed down to what will show up when you measure it. And of course, what shows up when you measure things is number and geometric form. So, if you put it, I'd like you to see that because there's a certain way where we accept the story that science gives us as a rendition of how things really are. I certainly did until I started to study philosophy seriously. So the table, although it appears, you know, to me, it really is made of atoms and molecules. The reality of things is what science tells us it is. Even if we don't know exactly what science tells us it is, there's a kind of a deeper sense, especially if you go and study science, that, and I've got, you know, I can show you, I've got a great documentary where there are plenty of scientists who will do this, who will say, there's no colour really. What's real is the electromagnetic radiation. That's the reality. What you're experiencing is a kind of a subjective, surfacey, kind of unreally, kind of sensory, animal, not very real rendition of the real reality underneath. And the real reality underneath is all that science tells us it is. Interestingly enough, science isn't quite sure what it is. It keeps rescinding what it said it was before, because it finds a deeper level. And that's not to say it's making it up. The one thing that's important to see is science is not fiction. It's not people going to their imaginations and dreaming stuff up. But it's the point that Husserl's making here is that what actually happened at the beginning has been forgotten. And I need to go into this in just in a little bit more detail about actually what happens at the beginning. This is an extraordinary thing to suddenly say, here we are in reality, right? As far as we were concerned, medieval human beings would say, what's reality? It's this, right? You're there, computers here, you're there, this is reality. And Galileo would have agreed. He's saying, well, no, I'm now going to use a certain method to investigate reality as we experience it. And that's the method of objectifying it by measuring it. And then it becomes a mathematical world. Why has it become mathematical? Because that's all that's left if you measure it. There's just a mathematical model left of the world. And then Galileo starts to try and measure rates of acceleration of falling bodies, if you remember. The Leaning Tower of Pisa, and he drops things off the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Because his theory of gravity I don't mind telling you this because I think it's terribly significant if you don't know it. One of the great problems of medieval.
They fall at the same time.
Yeah, one of the great things of medieval science was trying to get rid of Aristotle, and Aristotle's picture of movement was that things naturally want to be at rest. Do you see? Because he's coming from
at rest, as in
they want to be still. The natural state of things on the earth, and this is Aristotle just looking into experience, is that they're at rest. They like to be at rest. He'd go even so far as to say that that things become more joyful as they come toward the earth, because that's where they're at home and at rest. And if you want to make something move, it's a sort of an act of violence. You need to push it, and as soon as you stop pushing it, it'll just tend back to its natural state of being at rest. And one of the things that one of the revolutions which Newton finished was to say, no, that's not so. How things really are is that if you were to take everything away, the earth and everything away, and you were just in a completely empty space, and you push something, it would just go on and on and on and on. And for us now, we kind of, you know, if you've seen the guys in the space station, you see it. Yeah, you sort of, yeah, I know that's true. You haven't been in the space station, but you know, when you get out in space and gravity starts to. But the medieval people had no idea of being out in space. They thought the Earth was the centre of the universe, and everything was tending toward the Earth. And the only reason that the planets and the Earth and the Moon and everything else didn't fall towards the Earth is because they were made of different stuff. It was just their celestial material, and they're affixed to these spheres that keep them turning around the Earth. Of course, they turn in funny ways, so there are spheres within spheres. There's a whole story there that we won't go into. But Galileo said no. How it really works is like this. There are all these forces, and one of them's, he hadn't got a clear idea of gravity at that point, but that's what he was talking about. One of them's gravity, and that attracts things to the Earth. It was Newton that figured out that it was the same force of gravity that was holding the Moon up. Do you see how inconceivable that is, really? I mean, okay, all right, if there's gravity, I drop something, it falls to the Earth. So what's keeping the Moon up? I mean, you must be joking, right? If it's gravity, then the Moon would just go... yeah. So it took Newton to figure out about angular momentum, that if there's a gravitational centre and something starts to fall, it can fall in such a way as it just keeps on falling. So you know what the moon's doing, it's just falling and falling and falling. It doesn't ever hit the earth, right? Because we imagine that there's a flat surface that it will be falling onto, but it isn't. It's falling toward the earth, but in a circular way. So it's continuously falling, and there you have orbit. And suddenly, with Newton, you have this, this is the mind-blowing idea of Newton. You have the, you suddenly realize, oh God, the moon's like the earth. It's just made of stuff, physical stuff, rock, and whatever else. Maybe it's cheese. I mean, they weren't sure at that time. But it's determined by the same law as what determines the apple. That's why the Newton's apple. It's the same force that causes the apple to fall that causes the moon to go around the earth. And suddenly, so same for the sun, same for Jupiter, same for the stars. Suddenly the whole universe is encapsulated in this unifying understanding, and the general feeling on Earth is that Newton has seen into the mind of God. But that, I digress, I jump out. We're back with Galileo and the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and he's dropping two objects off the different weights off the Leaning Tower of Pisa, he's saying that the force of gravity means that they'll fall at the same rate, but of course they don't. There's a slight difference, and the heavier one does get there first. And he then has to explain, oh, well, there's another force operating, which is the friction of the thing falling through the air. Hello, Wes. Yeah. But at the time, the Aristotelian view was so fixed in people's minds, they said, no, you're wrong. You said they fall at the same rate, and they don't. And it's a bit like politics today. Nobody actually listens to any kind of serious argumentation. A whole bunch of people who followed Galileo thought that experiment proved he was right. And a whole other bunch said he thought it proved he was wrong. Anyway, we've come to accept he was... Yes?
When you said at one point, remove everything and then something,
well, and I'm glad you're confused, because it's like we're back in the medieval times, because that was just it. Science started off by saying we're only going to accept what we can observe and what we can measure, and then just like that, then Galileo starts by saying, okay, let's imagine, let's take everything away. And they used to point to the medieval philosophers and say that they were all in their heads, you know, all intellectual and imagining stuff and inferring stuff that they hadn't observed. And suddenly, modern science starts with this, well, let's think everything away. How can you possibly do that? I mean, what it's entirely in Galileo's imagination that he's thinking everything away. What he's thinking away is something that he's already imagined is there, which are all the forces that are operating. In other words, he's got a kind of an understanding of what is already in him. He thinks what is what Newton thought, because Newton got it clear. What is all of these points of mass distributed in space with gravity operating on them. And for a couple of hundred years, that stayed as the vision of what is. What is stuff in space with forces acting on them. And what is that stuff? Little points of mass, which we thought of as atoms. Galileo is always thinking like that, and he's basically saying, well, think the Earth away. Think what space would be if the Earth weren't there. But of course, it's a pure act of imagination. So what space would be if the Earth weren't there would be a space with no force operating in it. And you have a little thing, a stone, and suddenly a force arrives, your finger, yes? Taps it, and then he says, and then what will happen is it'll go on forever and ever, which... I hope you see is, would it? Do you know why? You can't prove that. In a way, we've come to be able to demonstrate it by going out in space where gravity gets weaker and weaker. And we've actually, you know, we've seen it. You've got your little tool, and you're doing your spacewalk, and you let it go, and just away it goes. I mean, it's very useful when you're doing interstellar travel, of course, because you just fire your rocket and to switch it off. And off. Well, they're different domains, the domain of number and the domain of this reality that, in a way, now I haven't got to the heart of it. The heart of it, which Husserl, he's the first person who really explained it to me in all of its shockingness, is that what Galileo was doing was studying the rates that things fall so that he could work out a mathematical formula for the how the force of gravity operates on the material. You know, there's if a material has a certain mass and a certain density, and force operates, you can sort of numerically work out the strength of a force. Different forces have different strengths, and you can work out numbers that will determine how strong that force is. So that if you know the weight of an object, and you know where you drop it, how far it's going to fall, you can work out a mathematical formula that will then tell you how fast it's going to be travelling when it hits the ground, how long it's going to take from letting it go to hitting the ground. You can express the entire thing using mathematical notation that expresses the form of the relationship that exists in this world that the scientist has abstracted from this world. Right? The point that science has forgotten, that we've all forgotten if we get too involved in science, is that that's actually the order. The order is first this world, second the abstraction. The abstraction that says we've got this world of experience in which we live and move and have our being every moment, and we can do something, we can measure it. And then when we measure it, another world appears, but it actually appears in our own understanding. And it's a world entirely made up of bodies in space. And what are those bodies? What are they? And this is where I'd like to try and... You see, those bodies, if there's a pen that works here, as far as Galileo is concerned, because they're thought of entirely mathematically, are geometrical shapes. I mean, finally, they're points of mass, atomic points of mass. But when you start to think about a physical body having a certain shape, the way that Galilean science would think about that is what that really is because it exists entirely insofar as it's measurable. Is it's a mathematical object. And a mathematical object is like a triangle. So I just want to go into what a triangle is, just so that you know what a mathematical object is. So we draw a triangle and we say, it's a triangle, right? Everyone can see it's a triangle. Maybe it's my attempt at an equilateral triangle. Well, let's say it is. An equilateral triangle is one where all the sides are the same. And that means, if you know your geometry, that there's 60 degrees at each corner. Yes? Now, this is just an example. I'm just saying the entire universe, when you enter into Galilean science, becomes mathematical, which means it's made up of entities like triangles. Not that you ever meet a triangle in its perfection, but the idea here is that every object here, we have a kind of an imperfect sensory experience of it. And behind that, there is a mathematical reality that is that object. Now, I just want you to get the idea that a mathematical reality is a world of ideality. And what ideality is, I would just like to explain by telling you what an equilateral triangle is. So I've just drawn something there that is not an equilateral triangle. It's just a bunch of lines on a bit of paper with some numbers in. And an equilateral triangle is, the sides have no length. It's entirely defined by the angles and the fact that the sides have equal length. The lines that make up the triangle have no width. When you think geometrically, and I'm going to go on like this because I think it's important for the whole understanding of what we're going to go through. You're going back to Euclid. Euclid was the Greek who set forth what geometry is, and set forth a whole method of proof, of deduction, of basic principles that you can discover about the forms of shapes entirely by reasoning. Sorry to do this to you. It's not a maths lesson, but I just... So an example would be that you can prove that a triangle has 180 degrees. Any triangle. Before Euclid, if you like, you would you'd start drawing triangles and you'd say, yeah, well that angle's that, that angle's that, that angle's that. Let's add it up. It's 180 degrees. That's interesting. Let's draw another one. You know, let's draw one like that. That's a really weird one, right? Yeah? There's a really weird triangle. Let's measure each of these angles. I've just drawn it and I've got my little, let's say my protractor, and I measure it and you say, gosh, it's 180 degrees. And you just keep on going and going and going like that, and you'd say, well, every triangle I've drawn, all of the angles add up to 180 degrees, therefore, every triangle is 180 degrees. That's not a proof. All you've got there is that the 379 triangles I drew all had, it happened to be, came to 180 degrees. Approximately anyway, because you can't measure it perfectly, you know, when you draw it. You know, you don't know. Maybe some of those triangles, the angle added up to 182, but you weren't able to... How can you prove it? This is the core of science, you see, is that once you can get things in mathematical form, then you can prove, you can deduce things with absolute certainty.
So why was my statement of a recurring number wrong? Correlating it back through. Where was it
from? You were saying that there's a recurring number goes on and on as an analogy to a to a body going on and on. So it was an analogy. So it wasn't wrong.
Yeah.
But they're not the same thing.
Okay.
Yes? Is that
sort of
thing. Yes. So but the recurring number is an expression of infinity.
Yeah.
And the body going on and on is an expression of infinity. And infinity is... Yes. Yeah, they're two examples of infinity. But they're not... The reason the body goes on and on and the reason the recurring goes on and on, there are different reasons for that.
Okay.
Is that a...
Yeah.
Yes. I just want to demonstrate a quick proof to you, just in case nobody in your maths class somewhere, and this should have been, you know, day one, maybe at secondary school, say, God, let me show you proof. It's such an amazing thing. It totally changed the world. There wasn't just proof from day one, right? It was the Greeks that really it came upon them as a total revelation. You know, maths once upon a time was like, having an orgasm, I think, something along those lines, or a religious revelation. And proof is this amazing... Let me just see if I can remember how to prove that. You've got two parallel lines. I've drawn those little arrows. You might remember that means they're dead aligned with each other. Yes? Now, all proofs rely on other things that you take for granted.
by the way. But the beauty of the Euclidean system is that the whole thing is based on a set of axioms, things that you take to be true. And those axioms that Euclid put forward were all things that he thought you could see in your immediate experience. Because Euclid wasn't quite as mad as Galileo. He did actually start from immediate experience. One of them is that if two parallel lines go on forever, they'll never meet. That was one of them. I just can't help telling you that Euclidean geometry is now not considered to be the geometry of the universe, by the way. The Greeks thought that's how it is for the universe, whereas you might be aware that space-time is now recognised to be curved. And if you want to know one thing that means, it means that the angles of a triangle do not add up to 180. It's not true.
Easy now.
Just let me, on one side, just so you know, the best way to imagine that is that if space-time's curved and you've got a triangle in Euclidean space, which is an imaginary space where everything's perfect and straight lines go on forever and they never meet, and you put that into a curved geometry, it's like putting the triangle on the surface of a sphere. Yeah? And the triangle, that if it was dead straight, added up to 180 degrees, if you put it on the surface of the sphere, all of the angles get distorted a little bit.
So that's just two-dimensional and three-dimensional.
That's an analogy, because, you know, you're right. You're right. That's an analogy, because we can't think what the curvature of space might mean. Because we have to think in a fourth dimension to think of that.
It's a fourth dimension?
Yeah. So the whole thing is, there's not...
So what is it again in space? What is bent?
It's space-time itself. Which is something that we aren't capable of visualizing things in four dimensions. Well, in a way we do. We visualize something in three dimensions, and we allow it to change in time. I mean, one way of thinking in fourth dimension is to say, it's a bit like a movie. Do you see that each frame of a movie is in three dimensions? Well, it's not in three dimensions. It's in two dimensions.
Yeah.
But we stick the third dimension in it when we look at it. John?
No, it's the same. We add that.
Yes.
We add the third dimension.
Yes. Yeah, we see the depth.
He said space-time is different to our
linear time. But you're right. I have gone away. I'm just letting you know that
it's really interesting.
Yes.
It's really good, yeah.
So what we do here with the proof, this is just an example of proof, right? Because I've just drawn something in there. It's very, very, very vague, right? But we've got an angle here, and now we start doing what the mathematicians do, which I know there's a certain point when some people never get past this to saying that the angle there is A. Well, you know, even that, to say the angle there is equal to A, is an enormous step of abstraction. Do you know what the certain level before for your ordinary medieval person to sit up, as we stand there and say the angle there is A, they go, no, it's not. It's about, you know, it's about 40 degrees. It's not A. I mean, in a way, when you do computer programming, which you live in a world of variables, you know, where you let this x equal any number whatsoever. If you follow what x is, do you see what an extraordinary, mind-bending absurdity almost? X is any number. What do you mean x is any number whatsoever? And generally, I mean, I went through learning maths at school, never really properly getting that. Because in the end, x does equal 3.72. Ah, now I know what x is. Do you know when you got your formula, you think,
well, x doesn't equal any number whatsoever. It really equals a particular number, and I'm about to find out what it is. But in effect, x does, a there does equal. That means it could be any triangle at all. I just happened to draw this one, and that's the angle in the corner of it. But what I mean is any triangle at all. The weird thing there about our mathematical thinking, if we do it, is we're already thinking of infinity. If you understand A, what it is, you're thinking of infinity, because the number of possible angles that it could be, as it goes from an infinitesimally greater than zero to infinitesimally less than 180. How many possible places are there for that line in between? There are an infinite number. Why? But because that line has no width. Do you remember I said that in the beginning? That can only be true if the line has no width.
It's like the turtle when it hits the... What is it? The story of the race.
Oh, Zeno's paradox.
Yeah, Zeno's paradox. You know Zeno's paradox? Maybe you don't. Where Zeno proved that Achilles could never catch the tortoise, because the tortoise heads out, you know, gets out a meter, and then Achilles heads out to catch the tortoise. So Achilles gets to a meter, right? But when he gets there, the tortoise has gone another 10 centimeters, so he hasn't caught the tortoise yet. So Achilles goes 10 centimetres, yeah? But he hasn't caught the tortoise yet, because the tortoise has gone a centimetre, yeah? And then Achilles goes a centimetre, right? But he hasn't caught the tortoise yet, because the tortoise has gone a millimetre. So Achilles goes a millimetre, but he hasn't caught the tortoise, because the tortoise has gone a tenth of a millimetre. And you see, he's never going to catch the tortoise. Now that's a proof that's gone wrong in some way.
Is there actually a point in space that it's
still up for grabs?
Can't get smaller.
Still up for grabs. It's up for grabs. That idea. What Alex is asking is space discrete or continuous? If it's continuous, it means it's infinitely divisible, and that things moving through space actually do go through infinitesimal movements. Or is it discrete, which means that what happens is that something appears there and then jumps to another space with an absolute discrete nothingness between the two. And I think physics is coming to an understanding that the universe does do that, that it jumps in a most weird way, like a movie. Like the entire universe appears in a fraction of a moment. How you can measure the size of that moment? What do you compare it with to do that? And then utterly disappears. There's an utter nothingness, and then it appears again in a slightly different configuration. Is the universe like that? We certainly don't feel it like that. But there's
in the process of it at the moment.
Yes, I mean for us, if it's like that, how would we know? Because in the bits in between, we wouldn't be conscious anyway, you know. And if we were conscious, we'd be conscious of nothing. We digress But back to this, in a way. It's all contained in ideas of infinity like this. Do you see, as soon as you think of A, you're thinking of infinities. As soon as you're in the world of proof, you're in the world of infinities, whether you knew it or not. Anyway, so the proof goes like this. Let's say A, B, and C. And then we go... We use a principle that we would need another proof to prove. But there are other proofs to prove it. That's what I mean. Euclidean geometry always falls back on the set of axioms that we accept as being true because we see them in our experience.
The principle of alternative angles says, well, if that line's parallel to that, then that angle A, yes, is equal to that angle there. This is one of the places where you say, and why? Because it's intuitively obvious to us. It's one of those things where you have to fall back on your experience. So that equals A, yes, by alternative angles. What am I saying? Yes? And that one there must equal B by the same principle. Yes? That equals B. Now that's a straight line, isn't it? And everyone knows that an angle subtended on a straight line, not everyone knows, is 180 degrees. That's what it means to be a straight line. Therefore, for any and every triangle you can ever possibly imagine, A plus B plus C, the three angles of the triangle, equal 180 degrees.
We're not on the curvature.
I shouldn't have mentioned that, should I?
No. Well, it was just grasping.
Yes.
Things.
Forget the curvature. Forget the curvature. This is in Euclidean space, which in fact we imagine very easily. This was Kant realised this, that in fact we carry a kind of a model of Euclidean space in our minds already. That's very interesting in itself. But that's just my quick example of proof. The whole effort that Galileo was into was it takes reality as we experience it, measures it, and transposes it into a mathematical world. And then that mathematical world for modern science has become the reality. Even though it is clearly something that exists only in the ideality of our thinking. Something's happened in our culture where we've made the idealization of the world that we've measured into the reality. And we've made the reality where we take the measurements into a subsidiary, secondary, and also, for that kind of science, inexplicable place. Are you with me?
No.
There's this amazing transposition of the reality of the sensory world in which we all live, and we don't actually doubt it when we're in it, and then we've created it through science, this other world, and you watch the science documentaries with this in mind and you will see that we actually, as a culture, we believe that that's how it really is. And the strange thing is, it sounds from there like, well, that's absurd, but then it turns out that it is the case that something like photons do impinge on the back of our eyes, and that those photons excite cone cells that then send signals back into our visual cortex, and the activity in our visual cortex is the cause, if you like, of our seeing, in the sense that if you obliterate the visual cortex, you don't see anymore. There's a kind of a proof in it. So, you see, what science discovers about the world is not untrue. That's its that's why it seems so utterly convincing.
It's like it's one angle of something, and then there's lots more.
Yes.
And it's like us in a certain lens looking in.
Exactly. Yes. And what's happened in our, to a large extent in our civilization, is the forgetting of the origins of this abstraction. Because what the abstraction has achieved for us is, first, what I said, everybody agreed, because it was only about what was measurable. And then the second thing that I haven't sort of over-emphasized is that Galileo started with things that you could measure and see. And science very quickly moved from things you can measure and see into hypotheses about what it is that is causing what we see. Which is, do you see, we pretty soon leave sensory reality and we start moving towards what were first points of mass, simple atoms, but then these simple atoms become, clearly there's an atom with electrons going round it. We infer this. And that atomic model is like the triangle. Right? It's an entirely mathematical entity. But at the same time, we've got evidence for it. We haven't just made it up. We've got evidence for it, but the evidence for it is entirely based on what we can measure. It's no longer even to do with our senses. All our senses can do is tell us what the readout is on the measuring instrument. Yeah, we don't see the substructions underneath, and they are actually just models. Models that we've developed in order to explain the readings that we're getting on our measuring apparatus. You see, this is ontology, the kind of philosophy of being. We've got an ontology that has been that deeply embedded in our culture, that has been determined by the physicists. Yes.
What did Husserl have to say about the
material
evolution?
Now, I don't remember him saying anything about it, but he didn't. He didn't have an argument with it either. So the thing about Husserl is that he's in a phenomenological reduction where he says in advance, I'm only interested in studying immediate experience. And the first thing that he does in the reduction is he says, I'm going to put aside everything that science has to say. Because first, as I'm beginning to hopefully explain to you, firstly, because what it says gives us a certain understanding of being that means we can't even see our experience. You know, as soon as I talk to you about the colour you're seeing, if you're scientific, you don't see the colour, you immediately, if you're like me, you jump to the photons and the visual cortex, you know, where there's no colour whatsoever. So Husserl's approach is to say, well, the first epoche, which we're coming across, is the epoche of science. We bracket science. We say, all right, science isn't right, science isn't wrong, but anything that science has discovered and anything that science has to say about our experience, we put it aside for now, because we have to come back to this place where it all starts. So the theory of evolution is not accepted or denied. Because the theory of evolution is, of course, it's exactly that. It's a theory based on observations made by these little eyes and these little hands that have dug up those little bones. And yes.
So in a way, it's kind of making sense scientifically and mathematically of what you can make sense of.
Yes.
Banking that and starting to think about the other bits where you can't do that. Is that?
Well, all that we're saying is that. One way of looking at the universe is to treat it as an entirely mathematically. And if you do that, then the entire world of your immediate experience of being conscious and of being alive has been bracketed in another way. And then you look that way and you go headlong and you say, okay, we're going to measure everything we can, and what you get back is what science has discovered. And it's not made it up. There's a certain mathematical form. There's a certain form to experience that we can describe mathematically.
Is it empirical knowledge?
It is empirical knowledge. But do you... Yes?
So what about Berkeley and his sensualism?
Right, well, we're going to get to Berkeley in a moment. But Berkeley, because the... Although we've accepted all of this, I mean, it was very early on in the history of philosophy that everybody started to think that it's absurd. It's just the way that it's gone
those voices did not gain ascendancy. So that that's I'm at the point now where I'm going to say, phew. You see, that was just that was the 10 sections that you missed, right, about Galileo, Galilean science. Terribly important that he Husserl called it the mathematization of nature, and we've become blind to it in these times. We don't think that it's been mathematized. What we think is that the pictures that were presented at school and on the documentaries are of actual things. Yeah, when we get pictures of the quantum space or what an atom looks like, or
there are only concepts, but
but of course we draw them.
Yeah,
and when you have a class, you know, you do physics, everything's drawn for you, and it's made to appear that they're things like the books, but they're something. It's always like this. Philosophy's always like this. Somebody's played a card trick on you. You know, their hand has moved faster than the eye. They managed to get you across. And it's not that somebody's done this to deceive you. If you undergo a proper scientific education, then this is how you see the world. And the fact that you see the world differently when you get home and have tea, in a certain way, you don't even notice it. You know, you flip from one world to the other. I mean, this is the poor human race. We do this all the time. We have these totally different ways of seeing things. We don't notice it.
In religion as well, they paint God, they paint Jesus, and it's a man. As if Christ is it looks like a human, or like God looks, has eyes, has ears, or the angels. And people start thinking of this kind of, as if they look like human beings.
Yes. Yes, I mean, if we could start to think of atoms and molecules and the quantum level, but I mean, the marvelous thing about quantum physics, if you go into it, is that the quantum physics has started to realise that our idea of material, of atoms and molecules, is a kind of like a projection of something that isn't exactly real. It's the reality of matter is starting to disintegrate within physics itself. You know, but we're still, in a way, Newtonian. You know, our understanding of physics is still as Newton had it. Not because we haven't been educated, but because it fits with a certain... Do you see, it's just an extension of the kind of objectivity that we have naturally. Because the power of science is it's extended that objectivity from what's immediately in front of us and projected it into a world where it says, and behind that there are little atoms. And if you could see, if you had a really good magnifying glass, that's what you'd see. They'd really be there. And do you know? So it's like science in our understanding has extended our ability to perceive it to all of these immense distances. Absolutely, very, very tiny, and out to billions of light years away. But what's missed is that when you leave what you immediately experience, the rest of it is another kind of world entirely. It's a model. It's not the reality. Whatever reality is, I mean, that's a philosophically.
So we can't see it because light particles don't bounce.
But if we use that argument, we're being scientists, because the scientists will say, well, you don't see anything then, do you? Because, you know, the only way we ever see anything, according to science, and it's not a lie, is that photonic energy bounces off it.
Well, according to science, we can't even touch anything because electrons bounce off each other.
Yes.
So
and if you go into the science, then you pretty soon end up saying, well, they're right. But all of our sensory experiences are kind of an illusion. You know, I'm just walking through a field of photonic energy. I don't see over there. If you could see what you were in the scientific model, it's like you're just there's photonic energy, and there's no seeing. You're just kind of bumping into it like this. you know, on the back surface of your retina. That's what, that's all that's happening, is all these photons that are hitting the back surface of your retina. Do you get the idea? You're blind. It's a, but you might be getting the idea, well, what the hell is the brain doing? How does it make this room appear out of my retinas, just moving through this sea of photonic energy? And this is where I'm going to, you get dizzy, because in a way, I've just been telling you that the whole of science is a kind of a mathematical subtraction on immediate experience, and now I'm using that to try and explain what experience is. You got but you've got to be prepared to think like this, because it's not that the science is a lie. It's not that if the brain surgeon goes into your brain and disables parts of your brain, you stop perceiving stuff. So there's obviously a relationship between your experience and what's going on out here. The question is, what kind of relationship? I mean, I'm about to stop now, because we're right at the heart of what Husserl is trying to talk about. Last time I said, why don't we have a quick tea break? And then you all went and had the major tea break. I'd like to have a major tea break later, and just a breath now. You know, I think we need a breath.
When you say tea break, so no tea? Just
yeah, tea break without a tea.
Normally,
if you
normally you break about 12, John, 5 to 12.
Yes. Well, I've reached a somewhere. Let's have a proper tea break, and maybe we'll have a short cigarette break, or
yeah,
for those
yeah,
who don't
yeah.
smoke. That's all right. Let's have.
What are we doing?
I just like it to be no more than 12 minutes.
So it's
like
a tea
break.
12 minutes and do what you like. If you can slam some tea down in that time.
Massive and generous.
There's a kind of a kitchen. There's a kitchen where you can make yourself a drink. Yes.
Yeah. But in having another break, John, because the last time it went on.